Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, December the 13th. We will talk with a guest this hour who is a one-time anti-nuclear activist, someone who's not been a fan of nuclear power, who ended up teaming up with a scientist to tour the nuclear power world, from uranium mines to power plants to Yucca Mountain. And she ended up writing a book about it. She concludes in the book that resulted that nuclear power is the power to save the world. So, what do you think of that? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in Madison, please use 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Is nuclear power the answer to climate change? Should we be using more nuclear power? Is it safe? Is it clean? Is it green? We'll talk with our guest and welcome your thoughts and comments for her. Gwyneth Cravens is author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, your book read a lot like a novel, and then I hear it is you are a novelist.
That's how I started out. Mm-hmm. I've written articles on science. I've always been interested in science and sort of wanted to be a scientist when I was younger. But wound up writing novels.
Yeah, and what made you decide to write a huge book about nuclear power?
Well, it was a real surprise to me to find myself doing that too. Well, I was against nuclear power, as you mentioned, and I had grown up in New Mexico, which is, among other things, the cradle of the atomic bomb, and you know, just took it for granted that my friends. Fathers would go off to the Nevada test site or Bikini, you know, the South Pacific to test hydrogen bombs and so on. And there was a rumor going around the playground when I was a kid that Albuquerque was the number one Soviet target in the Western Hemisphere and that there was a mountain outside of Albuquerque filled with thousands of atomic bombs. And I think, I can't remember now, but I think I used that in a novel, that myth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I got older and I moved east and went to grad school and everything, I thought, well, that's just one of those myths, you know. And then sometime after the Cold War, when airspace was not restricted over the military base just outside of Albuquerque, I was flying home to see my parents. And the plane took a different route than it usually does. And I saw it goes over this mountain range called Sandias, and then there was a foothill that had been, the sides had been planed, and there were big doors, enormous doors set in the sides. It looked like something you'd see in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, my God, there's something. And it had three fences around it, and, you know. And I thought, this is some installation here. There's something going on in that mountain. And that night I was at a party with some friends who are flamenco artists, and I'm not a flamenco artist, and there was a scientist there who's the husband of a friend of mine who's a flamenco singer, Dr. Rip Anderson. He's a chemist and an oceanographer. And when I've written science articles, I've asked him science questions, mm-hmm. and he's explained certain laws of nature to me and so on. And so I said, you know, I flew over this mountain, and I'm just wondering if this story I heard as a kid was true, that there was a mountain full of bombs. And he said, yeah, it's true. And I was flabbergasted that it was true. And then we talked about that for a while, and there were thousands of bombs there. And I said, well, what happened? Are they there now? And he said, they're being taken apart because we signed an arms limitation treaty with the Soviets. And so we began talking about that, and I said, you know, I've marched to ban the bomb, but I never asked myself, "What? Mm-hmm. Okay, you ban the bomb, and then what? What do you do with the old bombs, you know?" And he said, well, we're taking them apart, and we take the uranium in the pit, which is the business part of the bomb, and we're going to turn that into, it's being turned into fuel for nuclear plants. And right now, we're turning Soviet warheads into fuel for our nuclear power plants. Well, I was floored. I was happy that the bombs are being used to make electricity on the one hand. On the other hand, everyone knows nuclear plants are dangerous. So that was the beginning of a long dialogue that's going on to this day. And so each time I'd see him on subsequent trips to Albuquerque, I would keep asking him questions about nuclear power, and he would keep answering me in scientific terms, and telling me things that surprised me and that I'd never heard before. And eventually he said, why don't you come and see for yourself, see these facilities for yourself. I can get you in. So we went on a whole big tour, and I learned a lot, and I realized that many of my assumptions were wrong. They were based in prejudice. And Niels Bohr has said the goal of science is the gradual removal of prejudice, and that's the epigraph for my book, actually. And that's the experience I had, and if I told it like a novel, it's a little like in a novel. A character sets out thinking one set of facts, turns out they're not true.
What I meant by that is that it was a story, and it wasn't hard to understand a scientific mumbo jumbo.
It was your
journey on this.
Good.
So let's talk a little bit about the journey. Why don't we start with the uranium mine? Uranium mines. Aren't some of those in New Mexico too?
Oh yeah, a lot of them were. I was very naive. I said, well, let's go to the Grants area. It's a town about an hour from Albuquerque. That was this kind of the center of the mining in New Mexico. They had two big uranium booms there. And when I grew up, you know, people's fathers went and worked in those mines and made tons of money. You could make $100,000 a year, $60,000 a year, if you were a good miner. So it was a very lucrative job, and it was all bought by the government to make bombs, mainly. A little bit of it went into fuel for power reactors, but there weren't very many of those in those days. So we went to Grants, and I was all ready to go down into a uranium mine. So we went into the mining museum there, and an old-timer told us that they were all shut down, and that there was no uranium mining going on in New Mexico. So we had to settle for the museum's version of the mine, which was they had built an imitation mine under the museum. So we saw, and it was equipped with stuff that you would find in the mine, like the big drills and the dosimeters, which measure the radiation dose. The miners, once they discovered that radon was causing lung cancer in uranium miners because the mines weren't ventilated, mine safety laws were passed, and the mines had to be ventilated. And all the miners had to wear these little badges that showed with film in them that would cloud up if they were exposed to too much radiation, more than the natural level that we all are exposed to. So they put big ventilators in the mines, and after that, the lung cancer rates just dropped to the normal populations.
Yeah, let me follow up some on the mining, because this is a question that comes up when we do programs on should we have more nuclear energy in this country. Is that the mining itself is dangerous and dirty and polluting, and you use fossil fuels for for the actual mining of the uranium, and a lot of critics just in that part of the process itself, and that
right.
It also, according to the critics, is typically done around Native American populations,
right.
It hurts.
Right.
It hurts the Native Americans.
Okay. Well, I talk about those claims in my book, and I believe them too. They're not really true. Okay, for starters, when the mining boom started in New Mexico in the 50s, no mines in the country were regulated. If you were in a lead mine or a molybdenum mine, and those were in New Mexico also, they were dirty, unventilated mines. And you were in New Mexico, you would be exposed to radon and other kinds of heavy metal mines because there's a lot of uranium in the rock, and that gives off radon. So any mining is, you know, generally unsafe and has to be made safe by regulation. So when, as I said earlier, they changed the safety laws, and then it's just like, you know, having seatbelts. There are fewer highway deaths because we have seatbelts. That said, being a miner, you make a certain choice to be in a riskier job where, you know, you can have a cave-in or something. But I want to point out something, which is uranium is extremely energy dense. It's about the most energy dense thing we have on Earth. And so a pellet the size of your pinky fingertip contains the same amount of energy as nearly a ton of coal. Mm-hmm. So a miner of uranium in one day brings out what it takes a coal miner, in terms of energy, to bring out in 1 month. So the massive amounts of coal that have to be mined can be compared to what you mine from uranium. Okay, that's one thing. Another thing is, it's completely untrue. Yes, fossil fuels are used. You know, trucks carry the, you know, the drills are run on, you know, I'm not actually sure if they run on electricity or diesel, maybe on electricity. But no, we're virtually at a standstill in mining in this country anyway. Yes, some fossil fuels are used to truck the uranium to the refinery and so on. But overall, the comprehensive life cycle of uranium from cradle to grave emits the same amount of carbon as wind power, comprehensive life cycle from cradle to grave. And at the University of Wisconsin, and I can't remember the gentleman's name right now, but they did a study about this, and you can look that up. So wind power and nuclear power have put out the same amount of greenhouse gases, which is very, very low. It's way, it's less than solar power, cradle to grave, puts out, and way, way less, of course, than fossil fuels put out.
Yeah. Let me hold you there because we have a scheduled break to take right now, and then we'll be right back continuing our talk with Gwyneth Cravens, who is the author of the book Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. It recounts her many years in investigating this subject, where she goes on a tour of the nuclear power world with a scientist friend of hers, and determines that nuclear power is clean and green, and many things she thought she knew about nuclear power was wrong. And the book is Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. If you have a question or comment for her, I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. This is The Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 this morning, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will discuss the politics and the religion of presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. That's coming up after 9. We're talking with Gwyneth Cravens, author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. And Gwyneth, what do you mean when you say power to save the world?
Well, really, at the end of the book, this won't ruin the book. You can still read the book, and I don't mean to ruin the suspense, but really, the power to save the world is the human will, our human consciousness and intention. Without that, nothing happens. That's the real power, and I give that away at the end. Mm-hmm. It is the power to save the world is not in rocks or wind or water or sunshine. It's within us to make the right choices. And if you have the complete information, and you have it in perspective. For example, we were just talking about uranium mining. If you just look at uranium mining, and you don't look at the other ways we extract fuel to make electricity, then you don't have a context. And coal miners die every year in this country, and they die not only of cave-ins, because they're going deeper and deeper into the earth, and so it's harder to rescue people and all that. They die of black lung. And then the burning of coal to make electricity, and I see that Wisconsin has you get about 70% of your electricity from coal. Burning coal kills prematurely 24,000 Americans a year. So, and nuclear power has commercial nuclear power to make electricity, doing its job making electricity, has not killed one member of the American public in its entire history, which is about a 50-year history.
Yeah, but then we hear of yes, it was years ago, but it's killed people near Chernobyl.
Chernobyl, mm-hmm. Yes. Unfortunately, that was a Soviet-run operation, and the reactor was not contained. This is really, really important. When I learned that, I was totally floored. Reactors, by law, in the United States, in Europe, in Japan, and so on, all must be contained within a building with walls like 5 to 6 feet thick of dense concrete and steel, and negatively pressurized so that anything rushes, you know, air rushes into them, not out of them, if something happens. And the Soviets had a reactor that was basically in a kind of a Quonset hut. There was no containment.
Yeah.
It's and by the way, the reactor was making plutonium for bombs. We don't do that here. Right. So it was a horrible thing that happened. It was negligence on the part of the Soviets. If they had distributed potassium iodide to the population, as other countries around them did, then the 9 children would not have died of thyroid cancer, which has happened. The other 51 or so people were all emergency workers in the plant, you know, firefighters or workers in the plant who died. So that's a total of 60 people. And they expect about 2,000 people to wind up getting thyroid cancer. If you have to get a cancer, that's the most treatable one. And that's from an isotope that came out of the reactor.
Yeah.
We don't have uncontained reactors. So we had a partial core meltdown, just like Chernobyl did, in the United States at Three Mile Island. That material was not released into the environment. A few gases were deliberately vented from the tall stacks and blew out over the ocean. And the exposure, the average exposure in Pennsylvania to people in that area was tiny. It was 1 millirem. And the natural background radiation in Pennsylvania was about 100 millirem. So if the people around Three Mile Island moved to Denver, the natural radiation around there is 700 millirem. So they would have been increasing their radiation exposure sevenfold if they had left the Three Mile Island area to live in nice, clean, power plant-free Denver. So, yes, you hear... So even with those deaths, nuclear power has the best track record of any large-scale way of producing energy. And there's something important to know about large-scale ways of producing energy. There's something called baseload, and I did not know what this was. And until I understood it, I kept begging Rip, the scientist I was with, to say that we could do everything with wind power, or we could do everything with solar power. Why not? You know, it's so great. Well, he agreed it's good, and it can do supplemental work, but it's like an employee who doesn't show up regularly. When they show up, they're great, but when they don't show up, you need some kind of backup. That backup is called baseload, and that is what keeps the factories, the hospitals, the schools, and if you're in a place that has electric trains, like I am, you know, the train's running. You get up in the middle of the night, when you go to turn on the light, you don't say, I wonder if the light's going to come on today. No, it always comes on, unless you didn't, you know, replace the bulb. So that baseload energy is made by three things: burning fossil fuels to make steam to turn turbines, hydroelectric power that turns turbines, and you get about 3% of your electricity from hydro in Wisconsin, or nuclear power, which heats water to make steam to turn turbines. Those are the three forms of baseload, large scale. You can geothermal is a promising thing, and it may be that one day we'll get maybe 10% or something of our energy from geothermal, but that's in its infancy in this country. So those are the baseloads. Those are the choices. And then for the energy to fill in, we have wind and solar.
Right. Many more questions about your tour, and we've been to mining, and
all
now
right.
We've been to the actual sites. But we have a number of callers who have called in who are most concerned about where do we put the waste.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I just want to say one more thing about the mining, which is that the mines where Native Americans live, they were highly paid jobs. And I talked to Native Americans who said they would go back in a minute and mine again as long as it was safe. So, but the Native Americans in New Mexico were a very small minority of the total number of, and there were tens of thousands of miners who came into the state to mine. So it's not like you just find out where there's a Native American population and put a uranium mine. It didn't work that way. And right now, the Native Americans have coal mines and coal-fired plants on their land, and those are really a health risk to them. Okay, so the waste. Excuse me. Yucca Mountain was chosen by Congress. It's geologically problematic in many ways. Nevertheless, the science is such that every scientist I talked to felt it could safely contain the waste for tens of thousands of years. It's deep in a mountain. It's in a kind of rock that the National Academy of Sciences says is optimal for storing nuclear waste. It's very arid, so you don't have water carrying. That's the main thing. You want to put the waste in an arid place so that water doesn't wash through and get the radioactive material into the water table. The water table is 1,000 feet below where the waste would be stored in the mountain. The waste will be inside, special steel alloy casks. They're also covered with a kind of plastic film to keep moisture out and air out. But really, that waste, which, by the way, are the entire inventory of waste is about 50,000 tons. That's for all the trillions of kilowatt hours that have been generated by nuclear power in this country. That's 50,000 tons. In 1 year, Americans discard 179,000 tons of batteries. They go into landfills, and they contain toxic heavy metals, and they're just out in the environment decaying. And those toxic heavy metals will be around till the end of the universe. So nuclear waste does decay down and eventually becomes, the level of natural background radiation. Only 1% of that tonnage of spent nuclear fuel is long-lived. Most of it decays very quickly. It's right now it's in spent fuel pools, and the most radioactive, the hottest stuff has decayed away. But you still have to protect it, and you have to be, it's shipped in thick casks. I saw the casks that have been tested many ways. You can read in the book about how they test them. They drop them on spikes and throw them in rivers and set fire to them with jet fuel. Nothing happens. The waste is safely stored within them.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll have more questions about this from our callers, but let me go to the phone since we have callers waiting. Dan in Wausau. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call, and I just really appreciate your guest this morning. I've actually got two questions. My first question is, one of the statements that Joyce said in your introduction was that you were more or less misinformed about the nuclear power industry prior to your investigating. Who was misinforming you? Where were you getting this bad information, I guess? And my second question is, what is it going to take to get the American public to embrace nuclear power, similarly how the French have embraced nuclear power, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, Dan, thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
All right. Starting with the, let's go backward. The French actually just decided they were going, they realized they didn't, they had to import coal and stuff, and they, the French have been in several wars over coal in the eastern part of France and the western part of Germany. So they wanted to be energy independent as much as they could. So they set out on a program that was done very well, and they educated school children about it, and they're doing, they, Finland has done the same thing. You start by teaching kids how nuclear energy works, so that isn't this mysterious, scary thing. So that's the French and why they're so successful with nuclear power. Where did I get my wrong information? Well, I was for banning the bomb. So in my mind, anyone, and I actually would run out and protest again to ban the bomb, and I think we should disarm as much as we possibly can. But I thought that the people who were for banning the bomb would be very honorable in their description of nuclear power also. And maybe they are, but their information is not true. Much of it is not true. They may have good intentions. And one of the things that happened after the treaties to disarm is that some of these organizations did not, no longer, they were sort of out of a purpose. They couldn't protest atmospheric testing of bombs or proliferation of bombs on the scale it was being done, you know, thousands of bombs in the East, the Soviets and the Americans and all that. So they turned to nuclear power, and they assumed, what they made the assumption that every nuclear plant was an atom bomb waiting to go off. Well, of course, that's the first thing I learned, is a nuclear plant cannot explode atomically. To explode, to have a bomb, you need uranium that's enriched over 90% to have an effective nuclear weapon. The fuel in nuclear plants is enriched to about 3 or 4%. It's very weak stuff. It can't do anything. So that I got a lot of misinformation, and I've talked to friends who have been, in, you know, colleagues who are, we, you know, we've been united in banning the bomb. And once they learn how unlikely it is that nuclear power, it can be used to make bombs. You can't use the stuff from a nuclear plant to make a bomb. You know, an atomic bomb. They look differently on nuclear power, and they are saying, you know, I've just gotten all my information from anti-bomb people. Well, I recommend that people check universities, the National Academies, you know, the National Academy of Sciences, go the national laboratories, go to scientific sources. And in my book, I could give a lot of references in the back of the book to where I got my information, and everything these scientists I interviewed told me, I double-checked against other scientists and against the literature, the World Health Organization, the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, and so on. These are very good resources for getting independent verification on things.
Let me remind listeners, we are talking with Gwyneth Cravens, author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. Gwyneth Cravens has published several novels. Her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in The New Yorker, where she also worked as fiction editor, and in Harper's Magazine, where she was associate editor. She has also written a number of articles on science and other topics for numerous publications. This book recounts her travels with a scientist through the nuclear energy world, from uranium mines to plants to Yucca Mountain, the proposed national waste repository site. And she concludes in the book that nuclear power is safe and green. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions for her. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 4, find out about the latest Badger poll results on health care. What do Wisconsinites want to see when it comes to a health care system? That's after 4 this afternoon. Kathleen Dunn and her guest will talk about presidential candidate Mike Huckabee coming up after 9. We're talking about nuclear power, nuclear energy, with a former anti-nuclear activist who has now written a book, Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. And back to the phones. Al in La Crosse is with us next. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Good morning. Your guest has suggested that if you compare the fossil fuel emissions of nuclear power with wind, they come out about the same. I think this is a gross misrepresentation of the danger of nuclear power, and particularly uranium mining. The only way that you could compare the emissions from nuclear power with wind power is if you ignore the significant fossil fuel emissions that would be required to remediate or to stabilize and neutralize the radioactive emissions from the uranium tailings that are produced as a consequence of uranium mining. The vast majority of the rock that comes out of the ground to make uranium for nuclear power ends up as radioactive waste. The uranium has been taken out, but other radioactive elements remain in that waste and are piled in 200 million tons of radioactive tailings, mostly on Native American land in the Southwest. Those radioactive tailings emissions are responsible for the health effects of cancer and other diseases in Native American communities, including reproductive and intergenerational genetic defects. So I think your guest is fundamentally misrepresenting the problems of nuclear power.
Al, hold on. I'll give you a follow-up. What about that charge, Gwyneth Cravens?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I visited the tailings, and I have to tell you that the EPA has mandated that they all be stabilized and capped. The problem is the dust from them, and it's not the uranium. The most fissile stuff has been extracted. What you have is thorium, which is can also, by the way, be used to run reactors. So the thorium gives off decays and gives off radon. So you cover the tailings, they bulldoze them, they cover them with, you know, they shape them into a kind of a natural form. They then cover them with clay, which holds the formation in place and keeps the radon inside the tailings, and then they cover them with river rock. It's true, this is low-level radioactive waste, but it's decaying. This is not causing disease among Native Americans. There have been tragic consequences from uranium mining. I don't mean to minimize that. From people who took tailings, often Native Americans, who took tailings that were handy for making houses and lived in them, and they got poisoning from that. Also in that area, because uranium is in the water table naturally, people get kidney disease and things like that. So
you're saying that's because it's there naturally, not because
it's there naturally. And by the way, I don't think I talked to the people who at the University of New Mexico who monitor cancer and radiation effects in New Mexico. When I talked to radiation biologists, they are not seeing genetic defects that are attributable to radiation exposure. Unfortunately, in the population, there's a natural level of, birth defects. And even in Chernobyl, where people really were exposed to some radiation, they really were, the towns that got that exposure, there's not they've been following them for 20 years, the health of these people. The World Health Organization and other international independent studies have not found any increase in birth defects. In some areas, they've gone down. In other areas that did not get contaminated, they've gone up. It's a spontaneous human thing that happens everywhere in the world.
Well,
so that's the story on tailings.
Al?
This is nonsense. Laura Shields, Dr. Laura Shields at the Shiprock Hospital, has done studies of the residents around the Shiprock tailings area, found birth defects. This is published in the literature. I'm not going to argue the literature.
Well, you have to tell me, here's the problem with these studies. If you, for example, you test people in the mall, you just randomly test people in the mall for hidden thyroid cancer, you will find a large number of people have it. The question is, what was the birth defect rate before the uranium mining, and what is it now? John Boyce is an epidemiologist who's written extensively on uranium and its effects, health effects in the Southwest, and he does not consider these birth defects to be attributable to excess radiation exposure, except there were definitely cases of people who lived in houses made of tailings, or they lived on tailings. I'm not arguing about that. I think that the Navajo Nation, for example, has had a program to destroy those houses, to identify all the sites, and to make sure, to remediate those areas. So,
yeah, I know that Al's going to disagree with that probably
right.
too.
Well,
so I'm just going to move on to another issue.
Okay.
Al, I'm glad you brought it up, but we have many other callers and we're very short on time. Bill in Appleton, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I had a question, and I never heard this addressed really very well. There's a possibility, it's not huge, but it could lead to really bad consequences, I think. What if you had a disgruntled or mentally ill pilot flying a large plane, or you had terrorists take over another plane, and I'm not trying to be alarmist, but it's in the realm of possibility, and they crashed right into the reactor center.
Yeah, you deal with this issue too in your book.
Yes, I do. This was my worry after 9/11, and I did a lot of research on this, and it's in the book. A couple of things. One is reactors were remember I mentioned the containment building earlier. Those were designed for things like hurricanes and tornadoes, and which are actually much more violent than someone flying a plane into a building. But that said, are reactors safe? Well, what could happen if someone tried to fly a plane? Let's say someone deliberately did try to pilot an airliner into a containment building. If you go to my website, cravenspowertosavetheworld.com, and you go to a section called FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions, there is a link there to a film of what happens to a much heavier plane than an airliner flying at 500 miles an hour. They used a rocket power to ram this plane into a concrete wall, and you'll see what happens to the plane. Planes are basically big tin cans. They're not, torpedoes or something. And so the plane just pancakes. That's one thing. But the other thing is people don't realize how tiny, compared to the World Trade Center or the Pentagon, how tiny a nuclear plant is, and how small the buildings are as a target. So I don't think even a Blue Angel from the Air Force, those incredible stunt pilots they have at air shows, they could not pilot a plane into a reactor. It's just, and even if they did, it wouldn't disperse. The reactors are usually located 30 meters underground. They're in bedrock. They're not on the surface. The reactor isn't just sitting out there in an open field as an easy target. And there's another phenomenon called ground effect that pilots know about. If you somehow can go at 500 miles an hour at ground level, you actually can't because the plane shakes and so on. And if you're trying to fly at 30 feet off the ground, one nuclear operator told me that nuclear plants are like icebergs. You just see the tip of them. But the business end, the spent fuel pools on the reactor, are deep underground.
Bill, thanks for the call. An email from John in Milwaukee. Please ask your guest if they are if there are temporary storage facilities for nuclear waste until Yucca Mountain is opened. Well, yes, right now, in fact, in Wisconsin, isn't it on-site storage of the waste?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. They cool in spent fuel pools, and what nuclear plants are doing is progressively moving the fuel, which after 10, 20, 30 years is cooled down and easier to handle, from the underground pools to, you know, where they're below ground level, to casks, dry cask storage. These look like silos, small silos. They're on a concrete pad, and they are made of thick concrete, and they are air-cooled. And they, again, could not be a target for terrorists.
Yeah, well,
and they cool off there. And I'll tell you something about nuclear waste that I learned, which is it's very valuable. 98% of the energy in a spent fuel rod remains. So you're only burning 2%. That's like burning the bark off a log and then burying the log. So these nuclear utilities have understood that they have literally like a gold mine, because it's very expensive to mine and process and everything and turn relatively speaking, that's, you know, a whole part of the uranium cycle you could eliminate by reprocessing. So what is probably going to happen is that spent fuel one day will be reprocessed and used again and again. That's what they do in Europe and France and England. And it works out very well, so there you can continue to use that energy. And then the final waste is a tiny amount. For a family of four in France who gets 80% of their energy from nuclear power, the lifetime of a family of four, their share of the waste would fit into a coffee cup.
Yeah, so why don't we just keep on storing it in our hometowns and not ship it over to Yucca Mountain?
Well, I think a lot of people in the business, in the nuclear industry, have told me you still need Yucca Mountain because, for example, medical waste. We forget about how important nuclear medicine is, and that generates a certain amount of waste. So you do need a repository somewhere for waste that can't be redeemed. Mm. But probably they're going to set up Yucca Mountain that you could go in, perhaps, and take out stuff and reprocess it or extract important isotopes or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it would be more like a interim facility.
Yeah. So another email from Stephen Green Bay. Have any big-name environmental groups that are so concerned with global warming come out to embrace atomic energy?
I wouldn't say embrace. There's some prominent environmentalists. James Lovelock, who was one of the guys who blew the whistle on CFCs, you know, the ozone layer, the chemicals that destroy the ozone layer. He's a scientist, an environmental scientist, has come out very strongly in favor of nuclear power and is part of an important organization called Environmentalists for Nuclear Energy. Patrick Moore, a founder of Greenpeace, came out in favor, strongly in favor of nuclear power. In fact, he now works for the Nuclear Energy Institute. He feels so strongly about it. And the Environmental Defense and the Natural Resources Defense Council take the position that nuclear power has to be a part of the mix. Once you learn about baseload, you know that nuclear power has to stay on the table. If you say in Wisconsin you shut down your nuclear plants, you will have to build more coal plants. So more people are going to die from coal waste, and more mercury is going to settle in your lakes and poison your, you know, it gets into the fish, and I know you're restricted on how much of that lake fish you can eat.
Yeah, so why do you think the big environmental groups aren't embracing this?
I don't get it. I think that it's such a political hot potato. And my impression, and people have mentioned this to me quietly, there's a lot of debate going on in these organizations because nuclear power is the world's single largest avoider of greenhouse gases. If you have China and India expanding their industrial base and everything, they're building more nuclear plants. But they're all, the world is building and more coal-fired plants, and there are over 100 coal-fired plants in the works in the United States. And even, and by the way, coal waste is not regulated as hazardous, but it contains arsenic, lead, mercury, you know, the mercury that gets into the lakes where you live, and a lot of bad stuff. And, by the way, the waste, the fly ash, the solid waste that the scrubbers catch in the plant, you know, they just put it out back in a slurry pond. That waste can, if the pond isn't lined, it leaches into the local river or lake. Yeah. It's a dirty mess, and it's dangerous. It's harming our children and our elderly in particular. They're vulnerable to the respiratory diseases from coal.
This hour went so fast. We're almost out of time. Joe in La Crosse, though, time for you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Joy. A quick comment. Like your guest, I myself used to be hardcore anti-nuclear energy when the Clamshell Alliance was around in New England and the Seabrook Reactor was trying to come online. But over the years, I've spent a lot of time studying the issues and looking at it. And
right.
Like her, I've come to the understanding that it really is as safe as it's going to be in terms of what we can generate. And it's not a problem. I mean, if you look at the safety record in the civilized countries, if you look at France, if you look at the rest of the world, it's really amazing what they've done. If you look at Chernobyl, which of course was a terrible thing, we in this country looked at that reactor design in the 1950s and 60s, and we rejected it as being inherently unsafe. So it's not really a question of these horrible calamities that people anticipate. Can something go wrong? Something can always go wrong, but there are more people dying from mining coal in this country than in any nuclear accident anywhere, including Chernobyl, and that's in this country. That's not anywhere else. That's just right here.
Yeah.
So we really need to be aware of this situation, and we really need to continue to look at nuclear as an alternative, because if we don't, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot in a horrible way.
Joe, thank you so much for the call. We have less than a minute, Gwyneth. I'm sorry. Do you see the tide turning at all on this issue?
I do, and of course, my anti-nuclear friends have read my book or are reading it, and they're saying, "Oh, I didn't know this. I didn't know that." And really, if you read the book, I just described the things that changed my mind, and those seem to change people's minds. And I do have the scientific community telling me that I did a good job, so I feel okay about that.
And you have a website where people can look at some of this?
Yes, it's cravenspowertosavetheworld.com.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, Gwyneth Cravens is author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. Thanks to Leo Duran and Brittany DeAnda for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network.